Hello, I'm Rupert Sheldrake. I'm here with Mark Vernon. Hello, Mark.
Hi there, Rupert. Hi.
This is for another of our dialogues, and we have these conversations at fairly regular intervals, and we put them online as the Sheldrake Vernon dialogues because we hope that they'll be of interest to other people and help stimulate other discussions. We talk about things that we're interested in and thinking about at the time. And Mark, what I'm thinking about at the moment is trinities. And the reason I'm thinking about trinities is that partly because I think a lot about trinities as models of ultimate reality, and partly because in September 2019, I went to a theological conference at Cambridge called New Trinitarian Ontologies. And it's the first theological conference I've ever been to, so it was all new to me. But the reason I went was because people in the theology world told me that this was probably the most interesting and significant theology conference to happen for decades. It was all on this theme that interests me so much. And it also had an all-star cast of theologians like Rowan Williams, John Milbank, and David Bentley Hart, all of whom I find very interesting thinkers.
Just to chip in, I didn't go to the conference, but when I heard about it too, I did look online, and I think a lot of these talks are on YouTube, actually. So if you Google New Trinitarian Ontologies, these things should come up.
Exactly. Good. That's a very good point. Yes, because they should all be there, available. I wasn't there for the whole conference, so I didn't hear all the talks. But for me, the backstory is that theology is dealing with the nature of God, basically. And all theological traditions agree that ultimate reality, which we can call the divine, the absolute, the all, is conscious. The nature of God is conscious. God is, above all, a conscious being. When the God of the Old Testament announces himself to Moses, he says, I am who I am. I am conscious being in the present. It couldn't be put more simply, really. And so we have this idea of an ultimate consciousness from which everything comes forth. In an extreme form, that takes, philosophically, it becomes idealism. The ultimate reality is consciousness, and matter is kind of dumbed down mind. And there's a surprising revival of idealistic philosophy going on today. But I find the Trinitarian theologies give us some sense of the inner differentiation and nature of ultimate consciousness. David Bentley Hart, in his book, The Experience of God, which I think we've talked about before, shows that the basic model of ultimate consciousness is very similar in lots of different religious traditions. There's much more in common between them than divides them. And part of that is that there's one part of ultimate consciousness is consciousness itself, the ground of being, conscious being, which is the ground of everything and is conscious. Then there's the names and forms of things, the things that the ground of being can know, what it's conscious of. And then there's a principle of movement or change. Which is or joyful flow. In the Hindu tradition, it's Sat, Chit, Ananda, being, knowledge, bliss. Chit is names and forms, that which is known. Sat is the knower. In Kashmiri Shaivism, it's the knower, the known, and the means of knowledge. And the Christian form of the Trinity is God the Father is the ground of being and knowing. God the Son, the Logos, using the Greek word, is that which is known, names and forms. And the Holy Spirit is the dynamical principle of movement or change. I was interested to see in this new Trinitarian Ontologies conference what is going on in modern theology, because what is going on is in fact very interesting. When in the 17th century the deeper theological understanding of nature was displaced by a scientific worldview that says nature is nothing, it's a machine, matter's self-existence once it's come into being, and it works automatically. The main role God had in that worldview was as a creator of machinery, as a mathematical designer, of an intelligent designer of the machinery of nature. But having designed it and started it off, it went on more or less automatically on its own. And that's the worldview we've inherited in mechanistic materialism. And God became entirely superfluous because it was then easy to say, well, the universe is eternal, which in the early 19th century materialists said, and so you don't need a creator, you've just got eternal laws and eternal matter. This prepared the way for a kind of thoroughgoing atheism, which is still very much part of the worldview of a lot of educated people today. But new Trinitarian ontologies is saying, no, the actual ultimate ground of all things is conscious. And this becomes very relevant to consciousness studies, because we realize that actually materialism has no explanation of consciousness. In fact, a lot of materialists pretend it doesn't even exist, or at least do anything. So that's its weakest point. And if there is consciousness in humans, then panpsychists, a growing number of people, think, well, there must be consciousness all through nature. And then it raises the question, well, is there a consciousness beyond nature that's in all things, that precedes all things in some sense, that transcends all things? And then you get a panentheistic view, God in nature and nature in God. And this ultimate consciousness then is Trinitarian. And ontologies is about the fact this is a mode of being. It's a being, it's not just some kind of peripheral biblical criticism on the edge of a materialistic, mechanistic world. The ultimate reality is Trinitarian, and this is reflected in all nature. Well, this is why I'm interested, and this is why I wanted to see what these theologians had to say on the subject.
Yeah, well, I was interested to listen in when I heard about it, because as a sort of cradle Christian, the doctrine of the Trinity has always been this slightly clunky, confusing idea that people try and find analogies for, like a three-leaf clover, or talk about it in filial terms, the Father and the Son, and then the love between them. But it's always felt in churches it can be a struggle to really make it come alive, so that it does feel like capturing something of your own experience of what it is to be conscious, that then can be perceived as a sort of reflection or an echo of the divine consciousness, within which our consciousness arises. And there are two ways which it came more alive for me, actually. One is, was reading actually the physicist Roger Penrose, who is one of the rare creatures in modern physics that he's an overt Platonist, by which he partly means that the world of physics makes most sense to him when he sees it in three perspectives. And he talks about the world of matter, the world of mind, and then the world of math. And he thinks that what physics is so amazing about is that his world of mind, as it were, as the physicist, can access the world of matter through the world of mathematics. And so he sees this kind of this Trinitarian form that's deeply embedded in the practice of physics. So that was when he explained that, he explains it in many places. That sort of appealed to me. The idea started to come alive a bit. And then the other place where it really came to life for me actually was in psychotherapy. And in psychotherapy, we quite often talk about the third position. And broadly, this is the idea that the person who's come to speak with you is, as it were, themselves wrestling with something that they feel oppressed by, or they can't disidentify from, or is too powerfully, destructively shaping their life. So you can think of that in terms of them being caught in a kind of dyad. There's them and their problem, and they can't find a way out of it, which is why they've come to you. And they've come to you because, as it were, you're a third that is trying to create some sort of three-dimensional space within which what has felt so trapping can have a bit more room to breathe and manoeuvre. And so the Trinitarian sense of things quite naturally comes into psychotherapy. Another way that it can happen is sometimes that you can be talking to a client in the room, and you just get this sense that there's something else that needs to be expressed or needs to be aired. You know, you may get an idea, an image may come to mind. There may even be a sort of sense of presence in the room, that there's some sort of third that needs to come in. And so I've been really drawn to this because it seems to me that if you can think in three-dimensional space, then that can be quite liberating, if you can, you know, bring that in rather than being caught in these dyads. And then that sort of said to me, well, you know, is that somehow linked to the deep Christian and other religious sense that reality itself has this kind of three-dimensional form, and there's not just, as it were, the ground of being, not just the knowledge within that ground of being, but there is the flow, there is the movement, which is so important, as it were, for our health, for our mental well-being, which psychotherapy seems to have caught onto again. So, yeah, these kind of... And when I was listening to the conference, I was very pleased at one point, one of the participants, Andrew Davison, made a kind of witty interjection and said, you know, maybe part of the problem with the Trinity in the Christian tradition is that it's been expressed in these rather rigid ways, as if it's a kind of creedal juggling act that you've sort of somehow got to get hold of. And he said he invoked Donald Winnicott, who has this famous expression that that things must only be good enough, not perfect, because if they're perfect, we lose the capacity to play with them, to explore, to make mistakes, to sort of tease things out. And so I even wondered whether the spirit of psychotherapy through Donald Winnicott was kind of hovering around the conference. And it did seem that I don't know, you were there directly, but it did seem that some of the contributors, like David Bentley Hart and like John Milbank, were trying to sort of play with the idea to breathe a bit, get a bit of space into it again,
yes,
in order to bring it back to life.
Well, I think the whole conference was doing that, actually. And I think one of the points that came up was, you know, the philosophy of Hegel, which is sort of Trinitarian. You know, you have the thesis, the antithesis, a kind of contradiction, a duality, which can only be resolved by moving to another level, in which these two are included. And that this is an ongoing process. I mean, that Hegel's theory of the evolution of the spirit was a bit like your description of psychotherapy. And, you know, you see that in so many different Trinitarian models. One that I didn't hear discussed there, but and is surprising, really, as a Trinitarian model, is Taoism, where you have the yin and the yang, which are these interplaying, the black and the white swirls, where each has a bit of the other within it. And it's always this dynamic interplay. But it's not a dualism, because those two are included within the circle that includes them both. The Tao includes both these polarities, interacting polarities within it. So there's a third principle including them.
Yeah, I mean, I think you get it in Jungian psychology as well, that what Jung calls the transcendent function is when a tension between opposites seeks resolution by the introduction of a third space that enables a release of energy. And so you actually experience it in that moment, when,
yes,
you know, what has felt tense a kind of is released, and you feel your soul expanding in the release. Jung called that the transcendent function, which is very interesting use of the word, I think.
Yes, it fits this general model very, very well. I mean, the where I find it becomes like a personal thing where I can actually experience it and participate in this model is by going back to the very root of the whole metaphor used in the Christian Trinity, the word, the logos, and the spirit. And actually, this isn't something I heard discussed at the conference, but it seems to me the primary root of the whole thing, at least in the Christian tradition, that and it actually comes right out at the very beginning of the book of Genesis, where the earth was without form and void. And then it says, and the Spirit of God moved on the face of the deep, or the face of the waters. Well, the Spirit of God is the wind. Spirit, as Owen Barfield points out, as you discuss in your wonderful book, The Secret History of Christianity, A Secret History of Christianity. This word spirit, ruach in Hebrew, means breath and wind. And it's not just an abstract noun about some abstract concept. So the first thing we have is the Spirit of God, which is the moving principle of God, which creates on the face of the deep waves. I mean, wind blowing over the sea creates waves. So basically, a moving principle creating waves of vibrations. And then God starts speaking, and God said, let there be light. And we have the creative word of God, spoken word. And the spoken word has to have breath with it. When I'm speaking now, the words are part of what I'm saying, but the breath they're carried on is the other part. If I have just the words, they're silent in my mind. If I have just the breath, there's an outflow of breath, but there isn't words with it. And I'm the speaker, the source of both the outflow of breath and the words. So every time any one of us speaks, there's a kind of Trinitarian principle there. And interestingly, the modern view of nature in science, in the light of quantum theory, is of this general kind. We have everywhere in nature, all activity and actuality is the flow of energy. Energy is another way of saying spirit, the flowing principle. And everything that has form or shape in nature is ultimately based on fields, which are the formative principles in science. An electron is a vibration in an electron field. An atom is a vibratory pattern in the quantum matter fields of the atom. And so we have, you know, vibrations within fields everywhere in nature. And in medieval theology, like in St. Bonaventure, the idea was that the Holy Trinity is the ground of all being, is actually reflected in all aspects of nature. And so I think this conference, which is bringing us back to the idea of the fundamental nature of ultimate consciousness and of nature itself, gives a way of making sense of a huge range of phenomena, including our own experience.
Yeah, I mean, what you're describing there, you know, very beautifully, the idea of words and breath and speaker and so on. That reminds me of how it comes about in the Platonic tradition, particularly in the Neoplatonists and Iamblichus in particular, where he talks about how it's a really way of understanding the enchantment of matter. So matter isn't this just sort of dead stuff that somehow is disconnected from the pure consciousness, which sometimes it can feel like, as you say, matter is somehow degenerate ideas in idealism. What Iamblichus says is that if you have a Trinitarian structure, then you can see that matter gets its sort of vitality from the way that it reflects the ultimate consciousness. So it becomes, emanation is the sort of word that you know, sometimes images are used, like, you know, a thousand fragments of glass, each reflecting the light of the one. Or sometimes it's talked about as in terms of mirroring, that much as even in a small mirror, as it were, you could see the whole sun captured even in a tiny mirror. So too in the smallest mirror of matter can be seen the whole of the divine being. I mean, it's picked up by people like William Blake, when William Blake talks about seeing the world in a grain of sand.
Mm.
But this again has this sort of Trinitarian structure, because there's the ground of being, there's the matter that's reflecting it, and then there's the life that you see in the matter. The matter is not just, as it were, a dead object, a dead bit of stuff, but it's just itself carries the vitality of the one. I very much like how that. I think you need this kind of the threes, you know, introduce a natural dynamism. Aristotle, when he discusses, he opens his book on the soul, I think it is, by saying that three is a perfect number. And you think, why is he saying three, not one? Mm. And he says, because when you think about it, three enables a beginning, a middle, and an end. Or three in a tripod produces a kind of firm structure, whereas a monopod, you know, wouldn't be firm at all. And so even in Aristotle too, you get the sense that threeness, when you're thinking about the nature of reality, what it is to be, not a pure abstract number, but threeness, you know, the qualities of what it is to be three, he says that's why he thinks of it as a perfect number.
Oh, I didn't know Aristotle said that. That's very interesting. And of course, we find this in all sorts of traditions. I mean, in goddess traditions too, the triple goddess, and we see it in so many different forms. I personally find it the best overall framework for trying to comprehend reality. Oneness. My quarrel with sort of standard idealism is it has one thing, ultimate consciousness. It's the one, and that of course is the problem with materialism as well. I mean, both materialism and idealism in their modern forms grew out of a rejection of Cartesian dualism. And Cartesian dualism had reduced the threeness, which was pervaded all medieval thought, body, soul, and spirit. I mean, the threeness went through traditional European thought. But the scientific revolution, and especially Descartes' vision, reduced it to two-ness, spirit and matter, with missing out the level of soul. And then you had abstract spirit and consciousness outside nature, supernatural, and then matter, unconscious matter, as the basis of all nature. And that unsatisfactory dualism in the 19th century, you know, people who wanted one thing instead of two, the idealists said, oh, it's all spirit, there's no such thing as matter, it's just a form of spirit. And the materialists said, oh, it's all matter, there's no such thing as spirit, God and angels don't exist, and human minds are nothing but the activity of brains, physical, material activity. And so much of the debate in the last generations has been sort of two things or one thing. And, you know, the way out, the obvious way out, as you said, in psychotherapy, you know, is to have three. The Trinitarian principle is very liberating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's absolutely right. I do like the sense that the Trinity itself, though, is pointing beyond itself. That, again, part of the dynamism of the Trinity is it itself is a channeling, a sort of transcendent possibility that maybe is beyond perception, is beyond grasp. So in the Christian tradition, you know, you'd say it's three in one and one in three. You don't lose the one as well.
No.
Because the dynamism's got to go all the way through it, if you like. I mean, it reminds me when Dante ascends through paradise to the highest heavens, he's left all, as it were, human things behind by this stage. And right on the last canto, he has a vision of the Trinity. But what Dante does is he describes a number of impossible things to try and capture this three-in-oneness and one-in-threeness. So he talks about a kind of double rainbow that was creating the rainbow itself, and he talks about a sphere whose centre was the origin, was the circumference, and the circumference was the centre. And so he's using a lot of dynamic sense of interplay, which you do get in the sort of sense of flow between the two principles, like the Father and the Son, the Spirit flowing between them.
Mm.
So I do like this. I do want to hold on to the sense that it's not, as it were, threeness all the way down, because part of the genius of thinking about things in terms of threeness is that itself points beyond itself. There's always more, as it were. There's always something that's ineffable, a mystery.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's the kind of minimal generative principle. I mean, if you want to say, well, why not fourness? Well, you can find fourness all over the nature, in the sign of the cross, and you know, in four directions. And I mean, you can divide things out in four, fiveness, you can find fives and sixes and stuff. As John Michel used to say, the universe is reflexive, whatever you look for in it, you'll find. But I think threeness is not just like an arbitrary school of thought compared with people who say it's all fours or all fives or all sixes or all sevens. And because I think it's the minimal structure which has this generative principle. And it's interesting that in the deepest mystical traditions, you have the idea that ultimate reality is, of course, beyond our conception. The Hindus call it nirguna Brahman, Brahman without qualities. And then when the ultimate principle relates to the universe as we know it, then it relates through qualities, and you have saguna Brahman, Brahman with qualities. And Meister Eckhart in the Middle Ages said very much the same thing, that the ultimate being of God, the Godhead, is beyond all conception and all human understanding, because our minds are obviously limited compared with the ultimate reality, very, very limited. But insofar as that ultimate reality interfaces with and gives rise to and interacts with us and with all nature, then the Trinitarian principle is the form in which it does so. This is like the way in which the interface between the ultimate Godhead and the natural world and our minds as well.
Yeah, I very much like it when Eckhart points out that when you say Trinity, you don't mean, you're not talking about a quantity of God, as it were, as if God is somehow three, like he says, like three stones on the path in front of you. He says this is an expression of quality. And when you can think of numbers in terms of their qualities, that's when this really starts to come alive. So it's, again, your point about the quality of three having this generative principle, whereas the quality of four would be something else, would have a different sort of set of qualities. Mm. You know, fourness might be a demarcation of a space, for example, like in a square. Famously, Jung talks about quaternities in terms of... when he's talking mandalas that tend to have a sort of fourfold symmetry, and so that has a kind of property of completion for him. Fourness has, which is, it has a different sort of feel completely. So I think when you, that helped me too when I was thinking about what these means in terms of the quality of the numbers rather than numbers as quantities, which we're perhaps much more likely to first think when we think about threeness or fourness now.
Yes. I think the final point I'd like to make, since we're almost out of time, is that in my recent book, Ways to Go Beyond and Why They Work, the why they work part, when I'm looking at spiritual practices, is that I think that, I mean, what helped me with this Trinitarian view even more was seeing that different spiritual practices can relate to different aspects of the Trinity. So meditation, which is about going beyond thoughts and forms, is withdrawing from the senses and the world, and then within the mind, by having a focus on the breathing or a mantra, not being engaged in that whole default mode network, inner dialogue type of things, you go to the ground of consciousness itself. So there are moments when you can have consciousness without content. That's like the Sat aspect of Sat Chit Ananda, or the Father aspect of the Holy Trinity, the ground of being. I am that I am, a conscious being in the present. Whereas spiritual practices like sports, which, as you know, I think is often a kind of spiritual practice for people, or singing, or music, or dancing, are all about movement and change and flow. And I think those are ones that are there. It's about being in the flow. And I think that's about being primarily relating to the spirit, the flowing principle. And then spiritual practices like the appreciation of beauty, of flowers, or of works of art, or of architecture, is primarily about the logos aspect, that's to do with names and forms. And all of these are spiritual practices. They're all very different from each other, but they all relate to different aspects, emphasize one aspect of the Trinity more so than others. I mean, obviously, the Trinity is always bound, they're always present, but I think these practices enable us to tune in to or participate in different aspects of the Trinity.
No, I mean, that's brilliant, because I think that it's about discerning reality, and that itself is expansive. It makes reality 3D. It's not just as it were one is as good as another, but that one has a different take on reality or a different approach to reality, but it's still a take or an approach on reality. So I love that idea that that we can discern our spiritual practice, and that itself is enriching, because it gives us space to approach things in different ways. Yeah.
Well, I think the whole concept of the Trinity gives so many stimulating opportunities for expansion. We'll probably have to stop now, because otherwise we could go on for a lot longer. But I'm so glad we've had this chance to explore this, at least to start an initial exploration with each other.
Yes. Well, thanks very much.
Thank you.